From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott.
These rumors would spread that Brian McTeer is really sick and he's going to die.
Catch me if you can.
When I turned 6, life expectancy was about 8. When I turned 8, it was about 12. When I was 12, about 20. When I turned 37, it was 37.
There's always room to feel better in some way.
Living with serious chronic illness and shaking things up.
I sort of decided I wanted to make different shakers out of my pill bottles. Sounds great.
Also on the show, do forecasters really know how to predict the weather?
I think most of us get it right more often than not.
Yeah, I'm going to have to update this. Definitely.
That's coming up on The Pulse. First, the news. This was supposed to be a foot of snow, remember?
A winter storm is almost here.
And what did we get here in Philly? 2 inches? Why is it so hard to get this right?
I think most of us get it right more often than not.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. The Pulse will ask uncomfortable questions and sample jelly beans if that's what it takes to understand the latest scientific developments and treatments.
Injuries to the brain due to experience.
The same neutral, blank, indescribable nothing.
There are things that you do that influence your friends, friends, friends.
Finally, it feels like I'm in med school, you know?
Robots are really just computers with motors.
I had to actually learn to think like a sighted person.
The relationship doesn't seem like right. And
you feel a lot of happiness.
They're just giving you some of the medicine through your IV.
There's any point here.
What happened to you?
On today's show, how do pharmacies know what medications to have on their shelves and how much? And a new approach to treating HIV. But first, back to predicting the weather. Sometimes it just seems like all forecasters do is state the obvious. I mean, I could probably do that, right? Like this. We have about 3 inches of snow on the ground right now, and snowfall is coming down steadily, so we could be in for some accumulation by the end of the day. Reporting live from Philadelphia's Independence Hall, I'm Mike and Scott. So what's it like to be a real weather person? We sent Zach Seward into the heart of the storm, if you will, last Sunday night when we were going to get pounded with another foot of snow. He hung out at NBC 10 to get a sense of what they do there.
At the studios over in Ballack-Kinwood, it's the calm before the storm, or what's left of it.
Can I answer this really quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hello? No, don't say the storm's weakening. The storm is still going to dump quite a bit on South Jersey and Delaware, but, you know, it depends where you are.
NBC 10 meteorologist Sheena Parveen is prepping for the 11 o'clock newscast, feeding updates to the web desk over the phone. We're looking at a colorful radar map looping across a computer screen.
I don't think that people understand how much goes into forecasting.
I think she's right. First off, meteorologist isn't some made-up title. Parveen is one of some 500 nationwide with a special certification. She also went to school for meteorology in her native Florida.
And it's not just how to point at things in front of the wall.
It's atmospheric science and physics and even a little math. Best I can tell, weather forecasting is like being hit with a fire hose of information and parsing out what it all means. Sometimes it just doesn't come across that way.
Where do they think these graphics come from? How do they think that we forecast the weather? Like, how do they think we make the 7-day forecast? Do they think we Google it and put it in? Because we don't.
Each channel makes its own forecast, though they're looking at roughly the same set of data. And in a market where a botched winter storm prediction basically drove one TV weatherman out of town, getting it right matters. Each forecasting model has its own biases, Parveen says, and the human element to predicting the weather is about spotting patterns across different readings.
Sometimes it's a matter of opinion. When you have models that are disagreeing largely, like last winter we had a lot of that. We had models throwing 12 inches on us and some throwing 1 inch.
Over at the green screen before showtime, Parveen goes about her job without much fanfare.
I don't even think about it. I don't think about anything, you know. Never get nervous, so...
Never?
Never. Never.
Never.
Never.
Much of the info from which TV forecasts are made comes by way of the National Weather Service.
We put things up there to make sure that we don't miss the forest for the trees.
Sarah Johnson is a meteorologist at the National Weather Service field office in Mount Holly, New Jersey. She's talking about three big flat screens with maps and webcams from across the portions of four states that the outpost keeps a watchful eye over.
What's it been like on a fairly, you know, wintry winter to be working in meteorology at the National Weather Service?
It's been pretty exhausting. It's been one storm after another.
The federal agency keeps tabs on expensive satellites that take pictures of Earth's weather.
And then infrared, which gives us an idea of the temperature of the tops of the clouds, which can be helpful, especially with snow forecasting.
Snow is the trickiest part of forecasting, especially in the mid-Atlantic. The Weather Service has 122 field offices like the one in Mount Holly, and its advances in technology have increased accuracy.
Error in our 7-day forecast is now the same error that was in the 3-day forecast just 20 years ago. So it's rapidly improving.
But there's still plenty of room for improvement. Superstorm Sandy revealed flaws in the Weather Service's global forecast system. Another network of supercomputers in Britain, known as the European model, has proved even more accurate. Now, with about $25 million from Congress, the Weather Service is slowly upgrading its computing power. When it was announced last spring, it was hailed as a game changer. Reporting live from the Pulse headquarters on Independence Mall, I'm Zach Seward. Back to you, Mike.
Thank you, Zach, and you'll be back later with an update.
That's right.
Weather is a really big deal in local TV news in this region and on the radio, of course, but increasingly people also seek out alternative sources of weather information online. Tom Thunstrom is a banker by day, a weather tracker the rest of the time, and he runs a site called phillyweather.net.
What we do is we provide people who have a passion for weather a place to discuss it, a place to, you know, talk about some of the inside baseball behind weather, because there's a lot of information that gets out there. Sometimes it's misinformation, and we try to calm people to an extent, but, you know, also raise awareness when it's the right time to raise awareness when it comes to storms or winter weather, for instance.
How did TV forecasters do in Philadelphia this winter?
That's a good question. We tracked this every winter and we've graded them, and I just kind of use it as a subjective because everybody uses different forecast methodology and comes up with two things. One is overall temperature and then snowfall. People gravitate towards snowfall, and I always say every year snowfall is a wild card. This winter is one of those years, obviously, where it is. Nobody forecasted 62 inches of snow. Nobody came close to that. The closest forecaster actually was John Bolaris, who's no longer in TV, and he said 30. Most of the TV stations were 15 to 20 inches, which is pretty close to what we average in a given winter. We average about 21. But in Philadelphia, we've had winters where we've had 4, and we've had winters where we've had near 80, which was just a few winters ago. So, you know, snowfall here is incredibly variable. It's just the nature of where we live. And, you know, I think part of that, just that whole variability, it drives interest in weather. It's not like being in Minneapolis where, you know, you're going to get snow, you know, 20 times a winter, and, you know, it's going to be sitting there all winter.
Why do people love to get mad about this so much? They love when people are wrong. They love to complain about it, and yet they're glued to it.
Weather here is an interesting, just I think the whole watching weather and how much interest there is in weather. I haven't seen it in any other city that I've been in. I do think people want the forecasts to be right and expect the forecasts to be right. There's a high level of demand on that. And when there isn't, and folks aren't, as I like to say, they're not humble about their mistakes. You can see the visceral reaction in social media. You're like, oh, you're a weatherman, you never get it right. You know, they see that first forecast and they think that's gospel truth. You know, things change, things can happen that we can't, you know, that we obviously still haven't figured out and controlled.
Are there a lot of rogue weather people on your site who secretly think they can do it better?
I think what's changed in the whole conversation of weather, it's become much more social. In the past, there used to be 3 to 4 sources for weather. You had 3, 6, 10, the National Weather Service. They were your forecasters. Now you have private forecasters. You have Facebook weather pages. You have a lot of different resources that are out there. Some of them do a very good job of it. I think where they, in general, can get themselves into some trouble is when they get a little too anxious and excitable about the weather. I don't know if you recall about a month ago that 30-inch snowfall map that I think had 10,000 shares or something to that effect. If you recall, we had 3 inches of snow that day when we were supposed to get 30.
It seems like it's becoming a thing where it's like, oh, I got a guy who's always getting it right. So it's becoming this new, like, you want the guy who can predict the baseball outcomes, and now you want a guy or a girl who can always get it right.
Yeah, we're starting to see that, you know, and you know, I see my friends, you know, talk about that, you know, like, oh, this page, they do a really good job, or you got to watch this channel, they're really good at what they do. You know, I think most of us get it right more often than not. I mean, on the whole, it all averages out. And I think part of that's just because the science has gotten better. You know, the people who develop the computer modeling, the people who refine the computer modeling have done much better at getting this stuff correct.
I'm going to put you on the spot. When is spring coming?
I will say on or around March 20th. Not because it's what it says on the calendar, but that's about when we're going to warm up. It wouldn't shock me if we hit 90 in April. Years like this, in terms of the winters that we've had, where it's been cold and we've had kind of a polar vortex type of pattern, typically allow for a very, very warm run in mid to late April, where we get close to, if not break 90.
Tom Thunstrom is the editor of phillyweather.net, and there's another source of weather info, this one a little bit more old-fashioned. It involves a special formula shrouded in secrecy, one that's been around since the early 1800s. As promised, Zach Seward is back, and Zach, you chatted with Peter Geiger, who's the editor of the Farmer's Almanac.
Yeah, and the first thing I asked him was, what did you forecast for this winter, and when did you make that forecast?
Well, first of all, we do our weather 2 years in advance. So the weather was done 2 years ago. And when we released the almanac on August 26, what we said was that it was just going to be a very, very cold winter. We used the words bitterly cold, piercingly cold, bitingly cold, and a lot of snow to go with it. And that was pretty much for the entire country, I would say, with the exception of the north, west, and but pretty much the rest of the country. And as it turns out, that's exactly what it was. And it's just keeps on coming, and it's been an incredible winter for the cold, and of course when we also released back in August, the big deal was going to be the Super Bowl prediction, where we said that we thought there would be a storm during the Super Bowl, or at least there was a good chance of a storm during the Super Bowl.
And you just missed that one though, right?
Oh yeah, super. Well, keeping in mind that we do it 2 years in advance, and we did say somewhere in the almanac that we might miss it by a day or so. But the Super Bowl took place, which was outdoors, it started to snow about 2 hours later, and within 10 or 12 hours, they shut down New Jersey. It was a state of emergency. So we nailed that one so close that it is pretty much what we said it would be, which was this big storm that came in. It just came in a few hours after we said.
So the obvious question, obviously, is, like, 2 years ahead of time, how are you making these forecasts? What's the science behind, you know, long-term weather forecasting?
Well, in our particular case, the Almanac was started in the early 1800s, 1818. Our first editor was David Young, and he wanted to predict weather for farmers. But he was a mathematician, an astronomer, and a calculator, and so he developed a mathematical formula, which our prognosticator applies to sunspot activity, planet positions, the effect the moon has on the Earth, and the mathematical formula, and that allows us to do our weather 2 years in advance. And it's a formula that we have that has passed down from 197 years. There's been only seven people that have done the forecasting.
So I have a question about that. Who is Caleb Weatherby? Are you Caleb Weatherby? Who's this guy?
Well, I'm not Caleb. In fact, Caleb is the pseudonym for somebody who does the weather for us. So Caleb has been doing the weather for many years for us, and prior to that, everybody who's done it has done it for, you know, 25 to 35, 40 years, and it works out very well for us.
And I understand that Caleb is at an undisclosed location. You won't even say where he is?
Right. That is true. We keep him under close wraps.
So critics of your forecasts say that they're kind of vague and pseudoscientific. What do you tend to say to that?
Well, I don't think that they're vague. I mean, we're doing the weather 2 years in advance, and we have it in the publication. People can go online and see for themselves what we say. So it's not really vague. I mean, I can't say it's going to start to snow or rain in Philadelphia at 2 a.m. and end at 6 a.m, but I might be able to tell you that it's going to be a heavy storm. And I think, quite frankly, that this year we nailed it both in terms of our long range prediction, which was very cold and snowy, and the day-to-day. I mean, some of the storms that you've had are the storms that we called for.
And lastly, you know, almost two centuries you mentioned. What explains to you the longevity and continued interest in what the Farmer's Almanac does?
Well, you know, we're not a weather book. I mean, even though we talk about weather, the Farmer's Almanac really is a guide to good living. It really is an opportunity for people to look at a publication and then figure out how can they grow their own food, because maybe there's a lot of tainted food in the supermarkets, how they can raise chickens at their house if they want to, or just really neat little ideas. I think overall we're trying to be good to the earth. We're trying to be good to each other. The Almanac is a resource for people who just want to know how to do things and do it for themselves. And so even though the word farmers may seem rather distant, people that live in and around Philadelphia, it's a great publication for them, as just as it is for somebody who lives in Maine or in Utah or any other part of the country.
That's Peter Geiger, editor of the Farmer's Almanac, speaking with Pulse reporter Zach Seward. At this point, most of the snow out there is dirty, it's almost black, it's stained with dog pee, and just not very attractive to look at. But when you get mad about that, ponder for a moment the pristine beauty of a single snowflake. Tanya English has this end of winter reminder about the science and wonder of snowflakes.
I was raised up believing I was somehow unique. Like a snowflake, distinct among snowflakes, unique in each way you can see.
And snowflakes start as a water vapor in the clouds. When conditions are right, super cooled, and well below freezing, the vapor morphs directly into a solid snow crystal. Soon, other water vapor adds on.
Water molecules just get jostled around in the air until they find their way to the snowflake.
Ken Liebrecht is a physicist at the California Institute of Technology. He says at first, the crystal is squat and compact. It's nothing like the shapes you'd see on a Christmas card. But because of the way H2O molecules bond together, the crystals have six sides right from the start.
And this is partly why the snowflake forms branches, is that the tips of, say, a hexagon will stick out a little farther into the air, and the water vapor will get to the tip more quickly than it gets to other parts of the crystals.
And so on and so on.
And eventually they become heavy enough that they fall down.
Different temperatures and humidity conditions give a growing snow crystal its shape. It could become a familiar lacy star, but a snowflake can just as easily grow to look like a six-sided pencil. There's lots of surface physics to still figure out.
It's not that one has any practical applications of this. You just want to see if you can understand what's happening in nature.
Liebrecht studies and photographs snowflakes outside.
I will let snowflakes fall onto a piece of cardboard, and I'll watch and sort of look around for nice-looking specimens. And then if I see one, I'll pick it up using a little paintbrush and drop it onto a glass slide.
Meanwhile, mathematician Janko Grovner creates virtual snowflakes on his computer at the University of California in Davis.
You know, nobody can hang in the cloud and with a microscope and just see how the snowflakes form. They cannot just appear at random because the snowflakes are so symmetric.
Grovner models the tiny temperature shifts that snowflakes encounter as they grow. If we could just read their patterns, he says, we'd have a small history of where a snowflake has traveled. So, is it true that no two snowflakes are alike?
I knew you were going to ask me that question.
Grovner says technically two crystals could be identical, but it's extremely unlikely. Consider again all the different atmospheric conditions in a cloud. Even two snowflakes, forming right next to each other, experience the trip differently. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
And you can see some of Ken Liebrecht's snowflake pictures on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up on The Pulse, most of Brian McTeer's life has been catch me if you can.
When I turned six, the life expectancy was about eight. When I turned eight, it was about 12. When I was 12, about 20. When I turned 37, it was 37.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
There's always room to feel better in some way. Things have been so perfect, I'm still amazed to say. The greats keep getting greater, and my energy is speed.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. So we heard a lot about weather extremes this winter, the coldest January, the snowiest winter, and so on and so on. But those measures of extreme weather always come with a qualifier, since we've been tracking it. And that goes back maybe 50 years or so. A much richer collection of weather data is now being mined, and it comes from an unlikely source. For our latest citizen science report, Kimberly Haas went down to Penn's Landing.
On a recent visit to the Independent Seaport Museum, Chief Curator Craig Bruns took me back into the archives.
It's a typical ledger book. Each page seems to be a day. So this is a mixture of what happened aboard the ship, but also the navigational locations and a description of weather.
We're leafing through the logbooks that every ship, whether military or private, keeps for each voyage it makes. Included on every page is an hour-by-hour account of the day's weather.
Sailors are very keen observers of the weather, keeping track of these weather observations to know where the winds are. You know, without that, you're not going anywhere.
This goldmine of data has turned an unlikely department of the federal government into a bunch of climatologists. Most people think of the National Archives as the nation's attic, where the old records that are no longer used are sent to collect dust.
The diligent recording of meteorological data back 150 years that is stored on our shelves can once again be used for scientific research and analysis that helps us to better understand some of the most pertinent issues of the day.
That's Mark Milan, a Navy maritime archivist at the National Archives. They've teamed up with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, on a project they're calling Old Weather. They're transcribing the archives' collection of ships' weather logs, starting with Arctic voyages and going back to the mid-19th century. It's a huge job. The project's leader, Kevin Wood, is a research scientist with NOAA and the University of Washington.
The U.S. logs have 24 hourly observations, so that's quite a few numbers on every page. Barometric pressure, temperature, wind speed, wind direction, cloud cover, sea surface temperature.
Lest you think it's all just charts and numbers, there are lots of little surprises in those very detailed books. Craig Bruns at the Independent Seaport Museum showed me how the personality of the authors often shines through across the centuries.
And sometimes there are drawings. Oh, here in the way back of this, there are some clippings from the newspaper, little bits here and there, little jokes. So personalized a little bit. Sometimes there are pictures drawn that relate to the voyage or don't relate to the voyage, as we all do. Doodles, you know, we just doodle in the margins.
The National Archives' Mark Milan also notes the lost art of handwriting that's on display in the logbooks.
The penmanship of that time is very striking. A lot of beautiful penmanship, which you can see on those original pages.
At this point, you might be thinking this seems more like a history lesson than a science project. As the database grows, Mark Milan says the scientists at NOAA start taking over.
They are able to create weather patterns of the Arctic and see how weather patterns in the Arctic may have affected wind patterns off the coast of Africa, say, and then how those wind patterns off of Africa come back and affect the East Coast as far as hurricanes.
So where do citizen scientists come in? Well, the initial digitization included 500,000 images from the ship's logbooks. The only way it'll all get done is with the help of volunteers, who currently number about 12,000 worldwide. Old weather volunteers sign up and select a ship whose logs they'd like to help transcribe. You become a crew member and collaborate with other volunteers working on that ship's records, creating a new use for old weather. For The Pulse, I'm Kimberly Haas.
The Pulse has been partnering with the website SciStarter to present stories about citizen science. You can hear more of Kimberly's reports and learn about other projects at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. If you walk into a pharmacy this time of year, you can expect the cold and flu aisle to be very well stocked. But Mucinex, NyQuil, and all those other cold medicines don't magically appear on the shelf. Making sure the right remedies are available in the right amounts in the right areas of the country, that's a tough job. At Walgreens, a whole team spends all year trying to figure out when and where people are getting sick. Reporter Marielle Segarra has more.
I'm standing in the cold and flu aisle at a Walgreens in New York, and I'm bugging some customers.
My name is Ramik Benson. I'm from Brooklyn.
Can you tell me what you're buying?
Robitussin. I have a stuffy nose, congested, cough, everything basically.
Benson is one of many poor souls coughing and sneezing his way through Walgreens. Like a lot of customers, he's never really thought about how his cold medicine got to the shelf, but he thinks it can't be that hard.
No, it shouldn't be. You know what your customers want. And basically, the hot products always sell. So a manager or a store owner would see that and would know that.
Another customer named Lucy Alvarez thinks she's coming down with something.
Probably a head cold.
She's buying a cold medicine called Zarabies. She's not too concerned with how it got to Walgreens either.
They take care of that. So you're the customer. You come in and you get whatever you want and you go about your day.
Honestly, it probably does look invisible.
That's Dustin Sullivan.
I'm the category manager for cough, cold, and allergy, based here in Northbrook. So that's your Vicks, Mucinex, Zyrtec, Allegra medications.
Sullivan may be invisible to customers, but he's one of the unsung heroes of cold and flu season. He's part of an elite 8-person team at Walgreens. All they do all year long is try to figure out when customers will get sick and what medicines they'll buy.
The business of forecasting is, I liken it to rocket science. I mean, it is very sophisticated algorithms.
Reuben Sloan is the head honcho in charge of all of Walgreens' supply chain. I visited him at corporate headquarters in Chicago. The office is modern with lots of glass doors and windows. There's a gym for employees and a doctor's office on the second floor. Sloan is a high-level executive in a fancy suit, but he has a big smile and that Midwestern hospitality.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Reuben. How are you?
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Sloan says the team tracks the cold and flu through the South and up into North America.
So it comes up from the Southern Hemisphere, Texas, Florida, and then it can make a sharp left turn, go to the West Coast, or kind of right turn and go up the East Coast.
Then they look at store sales and try to recognize patterns. The team predicts things right about 80% of the time, but they're getting better at it. And they have a few secrets up their sleeve. To figure out when people are about to get sick in a certain town, they look at sales of other products.
Whether that's a hand sanitizer, even face masks, could be orange juice, could be facial tissue.
It could also be toothbrushes or chicken soup. Those are all part of the formulas. Because what's the first thing you do when you're getting sick? You say, hey, maybe if I chug some orange juice or change my toothbrush, I'll stave off this cold. Enough people do it that if the team sees toothbrush or OJ sales jump, they know they have to send more medicine to stores in the area. Even when they track basic things, like sales of cough syrup, they do it at hyper speed. Here's what an average day looks like.
So right now what we see is the Northeast, we're seeing sales increase as the flu moves up the East Coast.
Sullivan and the team crowd around a color-coded heat map of the United States that's projected onto the wall. It shows sales for every cold and flu item in Walgreens' 8,000 stores. A team member named Andy Kettlewell zooms in on New York.
We see a couple of things. One, Manhattan is on fire from a sales perspective out there. Total sales, you know, really cranking out there. And then we can drill down even further.
He clicks on the store where Ramik Benson bought his Robitussin.
We have a large increase, up 25% in syrups. We also see that cold sores are up 300% in this store.
That means Walgreens is going to have to send more medicine to New York stores, and soon. But this is an easy day.
Swine flu. It's infected 8 people in this country, 1,000
Carolina. That's a total of 50 cases now in 8 U.S. states.
Right now, and the official count of the number of cases is getting close to 100.
No one knew that people in the United States would react so strongly to what was coming over on the news.
That's Sloan again. When H1N1 hit in 2009, Walgreens did not see it coming. Its customers couldn't get enough hand sanitizer, so it ordered more. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended that sick people wear surgical masks. So the team bought a bunch of those, too.
People were panicking. The manufacturing base built all these face masks and all this hand sanitizer, and then suddenly the crisis passed and there was a glut.
The hand sanitizer sold even after H1N1 peaked. But the face masks? Those are still sitting in a Walgreens warehouse.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out what we're going to do with them.
The H1N1 pandemic was a big moment for Walgreens. That's when it realized it couldn't just rely on algorithms. It needed a team that did nothing but track the cold and flu. People who remember that Americans are too vain to wear face masks unless it's the apocalypse.
What does Walgreens stand to lose if you mess it up?
A lot of money.
That's Dustin Sullivan with Walgreens. He wouldn't say exactly how much money, but it's not just that. It's also customer trust. Here's Andy Kettlewell.
If you're sick, Walgreens has to be in stock on cough cold. We can't be out of stock.
Are they succeeding? Ramik Benson, the customer we met at Walgreens in Brooklyn, says there's always room for improvement. Have you ever come into Walgreens and they didn't have what you were looking for?
Yes, I would say yes. Some gummy bears and some gummy worms, but other than that, they're pretty good.
For The Pulse, I'm Marielle Segarra.
And sticking with flu season for a moment, only about one-third of Americans get a flu shot each year. Economists at Swarthmore College are looking for ways to motivate students to get vaccinated. They sent out four different emails. Some students just got the basics, where and how to get a flu shot. Other students got a second email that seemed to come from a classmate, saying something like, "Hey, I think you should get a flu shot." Yet other students clicked open their email and heard this. The message was, imagine feeling like this during finals week. Other students yet were offered a financial reward. The researchers found that students who were promised as little as $10 were twice as likely to get a flu shot. But they feel that a financial incentive combined with a message from a peer might turn out to be the very best motivator. And now it's time for Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping. This week, living with a serious chronic condition while being a creative force in your city.
My name is Brian McTeer. I'm a musician, recording studio owner, and I run a music nonprofit called Weather Vane Music. So it's cool. It's totally awesome. I have cystic fibrosis. It's a genetic disease. It primarily affects it affects all systems of the body, but I think the most problematic places, at least to start, you know, are the respiratory system and the digestive system. People with CF are constantly battling lung infection. For many people, it is the battle they lose, you know. Every morning and every night, I do about a 45-minute to an hour-long regimen of inhaled medications. They're like a mixture of mucolytics to bring mucus up and out of my lungs and antibiotics. So that's twice a day. On top of that, I take digestive enzymes with my meals. Oh, my newest gig is that I'm pre-diabetic with a type of diabetes that comes along with cystic fibrosis. So I've also started taking insulin before I eat. This is one of my pill bottles. This is for my digestive enzymes. I sort of decided I wanted to make different shakers, different percussion instruments out of my pill bottles. And I have I take a huge list of medications. I mean, it's insane. There's probably 20 or 30 different things I take. So I kind of aspire to, you know, making a whole set of shakers that no other studio in the world has, because they're basically based off of my medications. Sounds great, you know? I think I put lentils in it. Maybe it was rice. Oh, yeah, no, it's quinoa and a little bit of lentils. When I was a little kid, nobody believes me when I say this, even to this day, but when I was a little kid, cystic fibrosis did not have a negative connotation. First of all, I was very healthy, despite the fact that I had cystic fibrosis. I got a day off from school every 2 months to go down to Children's Hospital. It'd be high fives all around. They'd be saying, "You're doing so great." It'd be, I mean, I was just getting praised, you know. It wasn't really till I was probably 30-something that I really started to kind of, like, be a little bit angry at the idea of having this condition. Sorry it's over. I got really sick when I was 36. My lungs just felt like they were shutting down, you know. And for the first time in my life, I was really thinking of, like, the limitations on my life. When I was diagnosed at 2.5, the life expectancy was about 4 to 6. When I turned 6, the life expectancy was about 8. When I turned 8, it was about 12. When I was 12, about 20. When I turned 37, it was 37. And then I turned 38, and I was like, oh, wow, I'm kind of, you know, past due, right? And then they just upped it to 40, you know? So I've been what they call chasing life expectancy my whole life, you know? But what that means is, like, the treatment of cystic fibrosis is, like, a runaway success. Like, in a little bit of a weird way, all my life I've been sort of, like, minorly famous for having cystic fibrosis, you know? So all through grade school, I went to 2 different grade schools. On a cycle of about every 2 years, these rumors would spread that Brian McTeer is really sick and he's going to die. I'm 41. I just was curious about organ transplants. But my doctor, he said, talk to me in 15, maybe 20 years. And I said, 15 or 20 years, that's a long time. I might not be here in 15 or 20 years. And he looked at me and he said, oh, you'll definitely be here in 15 or 20 years. And you have no idea what kind of a weight off of my shoulders that was. I'll never forget driving home from that appointment. And for the first time in my life, imagining myself being 55 or 60 years old.
Brian McTeer is a producer, a musician, and he heads the Weathervane Music Project. Coming up on The Pulse, could you edit a gene to rid patients of HIV?
The precision of this required is really astonishing. So there are about 1 billion of these molecular codes in our DNA, and that needle in the haystack was actually surgically excised here, and the rest left intact.
That's next here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. For decades, the HIV virus has been outpacing scientists trying to eradicate it, often morphing and hiding deep in patients' bodies. Researchers at Penn recently tested a new gene editing technique with hopes that one day the approach could help rid HIV patients of the virus altogether. Their study came out this past week in the New England Journal of Medicine, and The Pulse's Alana Gordon has the details.
CCR5, that's the name of a molecule that has a lot of significance to HIV researchers, one that doctors at Penn recently modified in 12 HIV patients to see what would happen. For people born without CCR5 and have a gene mutation, they're generally resistant to the most common strain of HIV. Doctors have long known some people have a natural immunity, but it wasn't until the 90s that they pinned down this lack of CCR5 as the source of protection.
Recognizing that the virus needed this molecule, CCR5, that humans could live without it, okay, that was a breakthrough.
Dr. Jim Hoxie directs Penn Center for AIDS Research. About 1 in 100 people have this mutation. He says the discovery of CCR5's role led to a new drug, and more than that, created the possibility for even thinking about genetic approaches to making cells resistant to HIV without drugs. Which brings us back to the recent study involving those 12 HIV patients. Hoxie's colleagues, including Bruce Levine, set out to modify some of those patients' cells to see if they could rid them of that gene.
This is where the fun stuff happens and all the neat toys are here, instruments we have.
Levine and I are completely covered, face masks, onesies, slippers, inside this lab at Penn, where he and others are working to develop new gene therapies for HIV and other diseases. He points out centrifuges, which at high speed can separate molecules, incubators, where gene therapies do their magic in cells, special air filtration systems. It's here that Levine received the blood samples of those 12 patients and applied an agent to the cells developed by a California biotech company. It's a mixture of re-engineered proteins that are able to identify and latch onto CCR5 molecules in a cell, and then act like scissors and cut them out. Levine and others call this gene editing.
It's like tearing a page out of a book or tearing a chapter.
Dr. Pablo Tebas has another way of looking at this role in removing CCR5.
It's like closing one of the doors that the virus uses to enter the cell by removing it.
Tebas was a lead on the study and oversaw the patient's side. From Levine, he got those newly modified cells in frozen plastic bags, matched them up with the 12 patients, and reinserted them. Then half those patients stopped their normal HIV treatment for up to 3 months to see if those genetically modified cells had a better chance of surviving in the presence of HIV. 53-year-old Jay Johnson was one of those patients.
I would do just about anything to try to find a cure for this.
In closely monitoring Johnson and the other patients, Tebas says those modified cells showed signs of doing well in the body. One unexpected observation, the virus was completely undetectable in one of the patients after meds were stopped.
It was incredible, yeah. When you leave the moment, you don't think too much about it. And then when you look back, you realize that that was the highlight of this study.
Turns out some of the cells in that patient already naturally lacked that CCR5 gene, key for HIV. Again, at its core, this was a safety study to see if the procedure could even be done in people. To really determine the actual effectiveness of the approach down the road, more research is needed. It's a point Dr. Mark Kay emphasizes. He's a professor of pediatrics and genetics at Stanford University and wasn't involved in the study. Kay says gene editing may have applications well beyond HIV, but the technology isn't perfect, and it will be important to keep an eye on patients' health over time.
And the question that remains is, how substantial will these off-targeting effects be in the long-term treatment of these individuals?
Tebas will be monitoring patients for years. He says they're doing well. For him, the study represents a step, one step, that might be going down a promising path. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
All of us here at The Pulse talk to a lot of scientists. Obviously, that's part of our job. But we like to offer that opportunity to you as well in our segment, So What Do You Do?, where we team up a layperson with a scientist for down-to-earth conversations about research and scientific methods. In this edition of So What Do You Do?, public health student Tegan Keating sat down with malacologist Amanda Lawless and asked her, So what do you do?
I am a scientist at the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University. My background is actually in marine science. I don't work with sea turtles. I don't swim with dolphins. And I have never seen a whale in person. And really? That's usually what people think when I say that I'm a marine scientist. But actually, my passion has always been with things without backbones. So things like shells, crustaceans, crabs, different things like that has always been what has fascinated me the most. It's really awesome for me to be able to work at the Academy and to work in their Department of Malacology, which is where I work now.
Malacology?
Exactly. So I even had to look it up myself when I first came here. So malacology is the study of mollusks. We study the animal and the shell itself. A mollusk in general is just a soft-bodied animal that's able to produce a shell. The shells are made out of calcium carbonate. But the tricky thing is that not all mollusks have shells. So it isn't a defining characteristic. Your slugs that invade your garden, or after a rainstorm you might see them crawling across the sidewalk, those are actually mollusks. They just don't have their shell anymore. If you look really close, some of them have tiny little shells that look like saddles on their back. And some of them have evolved not to have shells anymore. Octopus and squid are mollusks as well.
They have their shells inside, don't they?
Right. So squid have internal shells, but octopus used to have shells. In the fossil records, we can see that they used to have shells, but today's octopus don't have any remnant of a shell anymore.
How did you get interested in mollusks and their shells? Was there something, like when you were a kid, that was really interesting and exciting to you about these creatures?
I've never wanted to be anything else. The first time I ever saw the ocean and I saw, you know, live animals in the water, and you're just like, how do I work with that? My mom was like, oh, you got to be a marine biologist. I was like, that's it. That's what I'm going to be. And it's so cheesy, but that's it. I've never, ever wanted to be anything else.
And if you love the life in the water, I would imagine that scuba diving or snorkeling for 6 hours a day is like the best thing that you could possibly do with your time.
Absolutely. Being slightly biased, since I'm from the marine camp side, I was like, oh, you know, land snails, you know, who cares about land snails? But then you get to look at them and you're just as amazed by them and what, you know, the colors that they have. And this right here, this large shell here, is actually a land snail. And you wouldn't think that something this large, would be crawling on land.
That's like six inches long?
Yeah,
8 inches long?
Yeah, and they get bigger than this. This is the giant African land snail.
If I saw that snail on a sidewalk somewhere, I would be very concerned and upset.
Calling the USDA, because this is an invasive species here in the United States. If you saw one of these crawling across, there's posters up and numbers that you should call about this.
Really?
Yeah. So this is an invasive that was a big deal in Florida not too long ago. The first one was introduced here by a little boy who brought it back as a pet on an airplane from overseas, made it through customs somehow, and then his grandma decided that he couldn't have it in the house anymore and that they should release it. And he happened to have a female who had eggs, who had laid those eggs, and these will eat just about anything. So they can decimate an area. They'll eat other snails, they'll eat plants, they'll eat garbage. But the other bad thing about these is that they're also disease carriers. They can carry a worm that, if you were to contract that, will cause brain damage. It goes straight to your brain. And so
they're the worst snails ever to have just
not in Africa.
No, not in Africa. Here.
Not where they belong.
Right.
But here, yes.
I have one more question for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Do you eat shellfish?
Love shellfish.
You do eat them?
I do. Mussels, clams, oysters, squid, octopus. You know, granted, not shellfish, but mollusks. I do. I love them. I don't know. I guess I love them all around. Is that horrible? I love eating them, studying them.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely.
This is fascinating.
Absolutely. Thank you. Hey, little boy, what you got there? Did you find it
in the sandy ground? Does it emulate the ocean sound? Public health student Tegan Keating speaking with malacologist Amanda Lawless from the Academy of Natural Sciences. And if you want to see that invasive African land snail that can infect your brain with damaging parasites, sure, I want to see that. Go to whyy.org/thepulse. Something being discussed in a Philadelphia courtroom right now could have
big implications for science funding across the region. For the last 15 years, the settlement of a massive suit against Big Tobacco has generated about $300 million a year for Pennsylvania, and a nice chunk of that money has gone to underwrite biomedical research around the state. But a new ruling might choke off the pipeline. The tobacco companies who signed onto the settlement complain that Pennsylvania hasn't lived up to one part of the agreement. This gets really complicated, so stick with me for a minute. The clause at issue requires the state to be aggressive in collecting taxes from tobacco makers who were not part of that celebrated settlement. Keep a level playing field. That was the idea. So arbitrators recently agreed with Big Tobacco's argument and ordered a 60% cut in how much money Pennsylvania should get. That would have a big impact on research centers such as Philadelphia's Wistar Institute. Here's Louise Shaw, a Wistar researcher.
For me, everything that has happened in association with these funds has been quite positive scientifically, and I think it's been in particular good for bringing new young people into the research.
The state has appealed the ruling. That's what's happening right now in that courtroom. Wistar is part of a coalition of research institutions that are supporting the state's appeal. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Jeanette Woods produced segments for today's show. Laura Benchoff is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our assistant producer. Meg Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news. And Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.